Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Oxfam's Response to the Haiti Earthquake Conference Call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, you may press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If you need to reach an operator at any time, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Friday, April 16, 2010. I will now turn the conference over to Ms. Coco McCabe. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. This is the first time that we've tried this kind of a thing, so it's possible we'll have a few glitches as we go, and if we do, please get in touch with the operator if you can't hear us or if we're talking too fast or if something happens on your end. So I'm Coco McCabe, and I am the features editor here at Oxfam, and with us right in Port-au-Prince is Amy Ansari, who is the Oxfam Humanitarian Policy Advisor for us. And what we are going to do today is start with questions. I will be asking Amy questions, and she'll be answering. And then we're going to turn it over to you, and I hope that you'll all have lots of good things to ask her about. She's full of information. So, Amy, why don't you say hello?
Hi.
Okay. So it's been a little over 3 months since the earthquake hit near the capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince. Can you give us a visual picture of what the city looks like now? You know, what you see each day as you drive to work? Is there a lot of rubble, people in tents? Paint the picture for us.
Okay. For me, I drive, it's about a 15-minute drive to work every morning. I live with about 10 other people who are all also Oxfam staff. We drive down a hill, and in which we get an absolutely incredible view of the sea and Port-au-Prince, and it looks absolutely idyllic. And then we go down a little bit further, and we get into one of the sites, one of the camps of displaced people within the city in Place Saint-Pierre. In this flat, in this square, there are 500 families living in very cramped conditions. We go down just past the Place Saint-Pierre, we turn left, and we pass by a building that has completely collapsed, and it is now pancaked. Just beyond that, there's another lot where a house has been partially collapsed, but there are about every morning 20 or 30 people working on this site by hand, taking out the rubble and the iron bars and whatever they can find of their belongings to clean it up, to try to clear some area so that they can start rebuilding their houses and their lives. A little bit further down the hill, closer to the Oxfam office, almost every day there is a cash for work program where people have brooms and dust bins and things where they clean up all of the trash in the street, put it into big trash trucks or big trash cans, and then it gets taken away. I've been here now for about 2 months, and the progress that has been made on this has been absolutely incredible. When I first got here, there was rubble all over the street, houses, half-collapsed houses in the middle of the road, and now all of that is gone, and Port-au-Prince is really starting to be rebuilt.
Amy, when did you arrive? How much after the quake did you get there?
I arrived on the 9th of February, so that's about 3 weeks after the quake. So in the first couple of weeks, everybody was pretty much in shock, and we were doing really just life-saving activity here. Since I've arrived, since I've been here, we've started to get much more into finishing up the life-saving part of our work and beginning to rebuild people's lives and rebuild communities.
So right now, how many people are displaced in Port-au-Prince? And I understand some have moved out to the countryside, but are some of those moving back in now?
There are estimated to be about 1.2 million people who are homeless within Port-au-Prince right now. It's a changing number because people are moving around the city in search of better places to live, in search of safer places to live. Some people are trying to move back into their houses. And as you say, at the same time, there were 100,000 people who moved outside of Port-au-Prince who we think are now trickling back in. But there's a lot of people moving all the time, and we're having Right now, we're having quite some difficulty trying to figure out just exactly how many people are here. We suspect it's between 1.2 and 1.5 million.
Amy, I couldn't catch the number that you said of people who had left the city. Can you say that number again?
I'm sorry. It was about 600,000 people, according to government estimates, left Port-au-Prince immediately following the earthquake. We think that those people are trickling back in, but we don't have any really good way of monitoring that.
So some people are living in Port-au-Prince, which has many collapsed buildings, and others are living in rural areas, I assume, with family or friends. So what kinds of problems is each of these groups facing? Are they different or are they the same? Are they problems with food, with shelter? Can you talk about that a little bit?
The problems for people in Haiti are largely the same. People have concerns about jobs, about their future jobs, about the education of their children, and about shelter. In the rural areas, right now we've just gotten into planting season, and some of the rural families are having a hard time because much of the stock that they keep to plant has been eaten by their families and family members and friends who have moved in after the earthquake. So AUXUM, along with a number of other organizations, is doing seed distributions, tool distributions, and fertilizer distributions to ensure that people can still plant. Within the city, it's a similar problem. Mass general food distributions have stopped right now in Haiti, so people are trying to figure out how they are going to rebuild their jobs and find new jobs in order to ensure that their families can eat.
Okay.
Did I answer the question, Coco? Sorry.
You know, that was fine. So why don't you give us a quick overview of the kind of work that AUXUM is doing. You said in the beginning it was more emergency work, and now that critical phase is maybe behind us and we're moving into the next phase. But describe briefly what AUXUM did in the first few weeks and what we're going to be doing now. And I'm thinking in terms of the water and sanitation, the shelter, the numbers of staffers we have in the country, that kind of thing.
Okay. Let me clarify something. It might be a little premature to say that the immediate life-saving interventions are over. For right now, they're over. But one of the things that we are planning for now is the hurricane season and the rainy season that are coming up, where we might again be in a situation where people's lives are threatened. In 2008, four hurricanes passed through Haiti and caused severe damage, and hundreds of thousands of lives were lost then as well. So it might be a little bit premature. In terms of what AUXUM does, in the immediate phase, we were passing out water. We were doing a lot of water trucking, which means we'd have big trucks filled with water that would go to places that were centrally located near sites where there were a number of homeless people and just distributed water to everyone. Now we've changed that work much more into ensuring that people have a regular source of water. So, for example, in the golf course, we were using the sprinkler system that was in place for the golf course to provide clean water to the people who live there now, who are camped there now, as well as trying to make sure that people have good sanitation facilities. And that always sounds to me like a very fancy way of saying toilets. Because essentially what we're doing is we're building a lot of toilets so that people have some place to ensure that they don't have to be exposed to violence or to any sort of lack of dignity when they have to go to the bathroom, which is something very normal that we all have to do. In addition, we're ensuring that there are places for people to wash their hands with soap and clean water and drying their hands. The other thing, most people in Haiti have lived in either slums or in conditions where they are familiar with less than first world standard water and sanitation facilities. So while they're very familiar with what they should be doing, one thing that Oxfam has to do all the time and keep refreshing the knowledge and information is ensuring that people are really using good hygiene methods, washing their hands, washing their clothes properly, making sure that dishes get washed with hot water, that forks get cleaned, the knives get cleaned, all of that sort of thing that we all teach our children when they're young, that you might need to reinforce when people get into a situation of a large camp. In addition, we're trying to help people to rebuild their livelihoods. So training people to be safe, doing some cash flow work programs, giving small business grants for people who want to open canteens for communities, just about anything that you can think of to make sure that commerce, that trade, that people spend money and earn money in a city to get the economy going. Those of us in the U.S. certainly understand that very well, I think. There's about 500 Oxfam staff right now employed in all around the country. They are, vast majority are national staff, are Haitian staff members. There are some here who face the same problems that those whom we help face. A number of our drivers and a number of our staff live inside the sites where we provide water. It's not easy here for any of us, and it is not easy for our staff who have to go home to very difficult circumstances and work 12, 15-hour days all day to help people.
Amy, can I interrupt and ask you to clarify a little bit? So you've mentioned a couple of times this phrase, cash for work. Can you describe what that means? My understanding basically is that we're hiring people to do jobs that need to be done. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Cash for work is simply, like you said, Coco, if streets need to be cleaned, but the Ministry of Public Works no longer functions very well here, as most of the ministries don't, then we hire, or another organization hires, a whole lot of people to clean up the streets. So we pay them an agreed amount of money, and all the organizations pay the same amount of money for a day's labor. What this does is gives people some money in their pocket so they can go out and buy, say, vegetables from a street seller who has come in from a country, from the villages to sell his or her goods. And that means we've got the economy starting to restart, which is what we want eventually, and that's how we can create jobs and make sure people can get back on their feet, because that's what Haitians really want to do, to stand on their own two feet.
How many people has Oxfam employed through this Cash for Work program so far, do you know?
I think it's about 40,000 people so far we've employed.
Wow. That's a huge number. All right, so it's great. Now, you said a moment ago that one of the concerns is with the approaching rainy season. So has the rain started, and why is that a worry for everyone?
The rains have started. It's not raining every day yet, but it does rain almost every day. And what happens is we get this incredible downpour. It's about 2 hours of massive rain that sits on the top of the ground because it can't be absorbed that rapidly into the ground. And you can imagine, those of you who have been camping, you can imagine what it's like when it rains really heavily and you've got about, say, 2 to 5 inches of rain out tent and, of course, seeping into your tent. If that's also the place where all of your belongings are, it's first of all, not very comfortable, but secondly, it's not very safe and sanitary. People are prone to disease and sickness when they live in puddles. So that's one concern. Another concern is that many of the sites where the displaced people are living or are on slopes that are prone to mudslides. So we're very afraid that some of the plastic sheeting and tents that we've distributed will slide down those hills. Now, we're doing any number of things, all sorts of things, to make sure that this doesn't happen. Lots of the people on the slopes have dug canals through which the rainwater can flow down into drainage canals. And those drainage canals are being cleaned by one of the Oxfam partners and through cash flow work programs to ensure that they don't get all backed up and clogged up with trash. Another thing that we're doing along with the U.S. Army and a number of other organizations is some engineering works to help stop mudslides from sliding downhill. So in other words, to stop mudslides. And that builds on some programs we were doing before the earthquake on disaster risk reduction and disaster mitigation. What else are we doing? We're also supporting people to move into to move back into their homes if their homes are safe. So we're doing assessments of homes and buildings to tell people whether or not they're structurally sound.
And what is your impression of that structural soundness? Would a majority of the buildings be safe to move into or not? Because what I was
hearing is
people were, even if their houses were still standing, many people were not sleeping in them. And I think there was some discussion about trying to figure out which houses are solid enough to move back into.
Oxfam, with a number of other organizations, have trained about 200 or 300, I'm not sure on the exact number this week because every week we train more, structural engineers to go out and assess people's houses to see how well they survived the earthquake and how well they might survive another earthquake. And there's a signage methodology where if it's marked green, then it's a good house and it survives and it's fine to move back into. If it's yellow, then it could use some repairs to it before people can move in. And if it's red, then people should not move back into the house. It should be torn down. That has helped a lot of people feel better about moving into their houses. Anybody who's been through an earthquake knows that it's an incredibly disorienting feeling to have the ground move. When also a lot of your friends and neighbors have perished, unfortunately, in the earthquake, you become quite afraid of really sleeping inside your house again. As time passes and as people gain confidence and when we assess the houses, people are more able to move back into them.
Now,
we estimate that about 50% of the buildings are green. And that means that probably about 50% of the population in the sites can move back into them.
Have people started to move back into those greenhouses yet?
About 12% of the houses that have been assessed to be green, about 12% of those people have moved back in. There is a lot of confusion in Haiti right now because the government has not yet been clear about what people can expect to receive. So there are rumors that if you're in a site, then you're going to get $50 or you're going to get a plot of land if you're a renter. And until we can work with the government to get those messages, to get clearer messages out about what people can expect and how they would receive any money or any compensation, we suspect that it will be some time before people move into their houses.
That's interesting. So tell me a little bit about the resettlement camp, and this is the last question I'll ask, and then we can open it up to everyone else. But I understand that Oxfam has been helping to prepare a new site with water and sanitation, and that up to 7,000 people are going to be moving into this new site, which may be one of several. So talk a little bit about that and what some of the issues are around moving people from where they are now to a distance that's quite far away.
Well, the first and immediate concern is the notification we had to set up that camp. We initially were told that people would be moved within 3 days and that would happen over Easter weekend. Easter is a huge holiday here. So trying to get our staff to work when it was really the first holiday since the earthquake was a difficult thing to ask of them, really, but also trying to set up a site for 7,000 people just with the water and sanitation was almost impossible. So, I mean, that was the main issue at first. The second issue was, how were we going to communicate which people were going to move to the site? Because there had been an assessment done of which people were really truly at risk, at immediate risk of losing their lives if they didn't move. But nobody had actually told them that they were at immediate risk. So we needed to work out a system for that. The most concerning aspect was the distance, as you said, Coco, away from Port-au-Prince. The site is, when we started working on it, it looked like a huge dust bowl. The sand is so fine that it gets, you know, under your contact lenses, and hurts. and to move people there 15, 20 kilometers outside of the town, where they had absolutely nothing to do, no livelihood options, no ability to make any money, no ability even to buy anything because there are no markets near there, seemed like an impossible task. We weren't sure anybody wanted to move out there. Since then, however, we convinced the government to give us a week to set up the site, and a number of people have decided to move out there because we've been able to make the site a much better place to live, and there is now regular private transportation going back and forth between the city and the site.
And why is that site so far away? Is there no land closer to Port-au-Prince, or is there no one willing to give up land? What are some of the issues around making these resettlement places so distant?
Well, Port-au-Prince, first of all, is a very, very crowded city. More people live here. It's very crowded here. So finding empty plots of land to build on is very difficult. And certainly trying to find a place for 7,000 people within the city is impossible. The second issue is land rights and land tenure are complicated here. Firstly, any documents that people had were lost in the earthquake, and the ministries have also lost a lot of their documentation since they collapsed. So there are almost no records of people's land ownership. So there are a number of different problems with trying to find land. The third thing that had to happen is that the government had to declare eminent domain, which means they had to essentially take over plots of land where they could figure out what the ownership was and then negotiate compensation for the former landowner. So that was, of course, another delay.
Okay, great. So, Amy, I think what we're going to do now is open this conversation up to everyone else who might be on the line. And it's going to take a few seconds delay while our operator organizes that. And the plan is that people have been lined up, I hope, and will ask their questions as their turn comes up. So everyone hold one sec, and Nelson, I guess, will help us.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register a question, you may press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. At that time, your line will briefly be accessed from the conference to obtain the appropriate information. If your question has been asked by another and you would like to withdraw your registration, you may press the 1 followed by the 3. Once again, to register a question, you may press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, to register a question, it's the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Please stand by for our first question. Our first question comes from the line of Marguerite Elias with Goldman Sachs. Please proceed.
Hi. Thanks for providing all the information. I was wondering if you could touch base about the morale of the people in general. And has it improved, or can you shed a little more information? Thanks.
Thank you. This is Coco again, and I think I'll repeat the question just in case Amy can't hear it. So that question was about the morale of people and whether it has improved since the earthquake. So if you could just talk a little bit more about how people are feeling now, I think that would help. Thanks.
Immediately following the earthquake, people were devastated, of course. 220,000 people here passed away. Everybody was touched. Everybody lost a friend or a family member. At Oxfam, we lost two very valuable staff members. Since then, the outpouring of assistance and the concern from everybody around the world has been so great that it has really buoyed the most of the Haitian people here, particularly in the first month or so after the earthquake, and up until the 31st of March, when donors and funding and international organizations came to help people. It really improved the morale and the attitude, and it made them feel like they weren't alone anymore. I think in the last couple of weeks in particular, I've noticed that the enormity of the task of rebuilding the country has started to sink in. And while I don't think there's been any decline in morale, there's been a real sort of, okay, now we have to sit down, we have to get to work, we have to get ourselves back on our feet. This is how it helps us. So it's been much more a constructive engagement with all of us who are working in Haiti, between the internationals, the donors, everybody here, to really start moving on the reconstruction and the rebuilding of people's lives and communities. Good question. Thank you.
I guess we'll wait for the next question. Nelson?
Yes, thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Garth Saufield. Please proceed.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you so much for all the information. My questions pertain to pretty much hardcore engineering. I see pictures of Port-au-Prince and so much of the concrete and steel rubble, and I'm wondering, because I've worked with machines that rubble that type of material or rubbleize and make it available for reconstruction, wondering if any of that is going on, and also what's been able to what the different agencies have been able to do for sanitation as to hard plumbing of from water plants, if water plants are still available and usable, and if sanitation facilities are being rebuilt. Again, thank you so much.
So this is Coco. I'll repeat the question for Garth. He was asking about the great volume of rubble in Port-au-Prince and whether there are any systems for reducing it and reusing it, and reusing it for construction. He's also wondering about the sanitation systems throughout the city, particularly in terms of sort of hard plumbing and water delivery systems, and whether or not the NGOs, the aid groups, are addressing that.
Okay, great questions. I'm right into my comfort zone there. In terms of rubble and rubble clearance and using that to rebuild, we are supporting an organization called DWR here, which is an American NGO and an American-British NGO that helps people to take down their what's left of their houses and use that to sell it, or to use that to, say, build roads or tarmac with some of the concrete that has come through, or with the rebar, because, of course, you can't reuse the rebar, to melt it down and to use it for other purposes. So there's a lot of efforts going on in terms of reusing and recycling rubble, and as Oxfam, we're really one of the leaders in that in the country right now. In terms of the sanitation systems here in Port-au-Prince, there was, I'm trying to pull the number out of my head, I believe that it was only about a 19% coverage in terms of public sanitation in Port-au-Prince before the earthquake. There was not even a very good wastewater management system or a place to put water where it could be treated properly so that it was no longer dangerous. Oxfam with UNICEF and the Ministry of Public Works are helping to develop a facility just outside of Port-au-Prince to indeed do that so that wastewater is treated properly. But in terms of the public system of sanitation, that's a much longer-term proposition, and that it's a strategy that is currently being developed by the Ministry of Public Works, with, of course, input from Oxfam and UNICEF and a number of other organizations. But one of the things we do to help encourage people to move back into their houses is we repair their water and sanitation systems if it's fairly simple repairs that need to be done.
Great, thanks. Next question, Nelson.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Dawn Wright with CCW. Please proceed.
Hi, Amy. Hi, Coco. My question, I guess, you mentioned that the mass food distributions have stopped, and then you also mentioned that people are sort of selling food on the street coming in from outside for the more rural areas. But how else are you, I mean, you have like a million of misplaced people. How else are they obtaining food on a daily basis?
This is Coco. I'll repeat that question. Dawn was pointing out that Amy had said that the mass food distributions have basically stopped in the city, that there are street vendors selling food that's coming in from the rural areas. But with so many displaced people and so much destruction, how else are people getting the food that they need?
Okay. The general food distributions, the untargeted food distributions, have stopped in the city now. However, targeted food distributions continue. So there's food in, say, schools and school canteens and school cafeterias that is still being distributed for free. People who are particularly vulnerable, households that are headed by women where there's no man, where there are lots of children, people with disabilities, they're still receiving food. In addition to that, there are cash for work programs and some food for work programs that other organizations run to ensure that people can get food. We, as Oxfam, are running what we call community canteens, where we support a restaurateur, or someone who used to be a restaurateur, to give food out to particularly vulnerable people. We've got about 42 of them in one area of town right now, and we're planning to expand that quite extensively. So there are a number of different ways that people get food. The people in food on the streets are sometimes vendors of cooked food already, but more often they're people who are selling fruit and vegetables on the streets. So they're farmers who come in from the rural areas and sell their produce.
Thank you.
Next question, Nelson.
Our next question comes from the line of Darren Huska with Dharma Construction. Please proceed.
Hello, Coco. Hello, Amy. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Good. I have actually three questions. One is, with the new construction that's going on down there, is there any type of code compliance enforcement currently being enforced or future? I'm here in California. I'm very familiar with being code compliant with seismic activity and such. Second, the medical facilities down there, has the general hospital been cleared for reoccupation? I know I've seen images on the internet of, you know, the OBGYN being conducted out of a tent. And thirdly, lastly, this new site of 7,000 people, what type of facilities are there? Is this a big tent city, or is it more of a temporary slash permanent housing situation?
Okay, thank you, Darren. I'll repeat your questions. First one had to do with construction and whether or not Port-au-Prince and Haiti in general have much code enforcement for their building codes, and maybe we should ask if there are building codes. He's a California resident and quite aware of the seismic requirements for his state. The second question had to do with medical facilities and whether or not any of the hospitals have been reopened for reoccupation. He's been seeing news accounts of OBGYN facilities out in the open. And then the last question had to do with the resettlement site that we were talking about before and what kinds of facilities it has and how they are different from where people are right now.
Okay, wow. In terms of construction and building codes, there is a building code here. It is based on the French building code, or the European building code. So the standards are really quite high and, frankly, not attainable in a country like this. We are working, we have a team of shelter experts in Port-au-Prince, both that are also on staff and that are people actually from San Francisco, working for a company called Arup, who are working with the government to make building codes that are more attainable. The problem with having building codes that are of such a high standard is that there's no way you can enforce them, and the government doesn't really have the ability to enforce them. So the key thing is to make building codes that are safe, that people understand why they have those building codes, and that they can actually make sure that their buildings are of a safe standard. The second question on medical facilities. Oxfam last week provided water to the main general hospital in Port-au-Prince, because their water system broke about a month ago, which is surprising that it didn't break in the earthquake, but it only broke about a month ago, and they've asked us for assistance, which we happily provided. Medical facilities are starting to work again, and a number of other NGOs in the country have been providing all sorts of medical care. There are gaps, of course. There are gaps in almost everything here right now, but all of us are working as hard as we can to fill those gaps as quickly as possible. 1.2 million people in an entire city destroyed. This is about the size of Houston here. Is quite an incredible and overwhelming task for all of us. The facilities in the new sites are head and shoulders, actually, above the facilities in the makeshift sites around the city right now. Partially because we've been able to plan the sites so we can make sure that everyone that every site meets the sphere standards, so every family has 30 square meters of living area, and that their houses are at least 18 square meters, that, what are they called? Toilets. Toilets are 100 meters from the nearest house, that they are in places that are well-lit at night, but also not terribly vulnerable so that women can go there safely at night. There are medical centers, there are spaces for children to play, and the children are going to local schools. So the situation in those sites is actually quite a lot better than in the camps inside the city.
Thank you. Next question, Nelson.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Malin Barish. Please proceed.
Thank you. First, I want to express my admiration to both of you for your hard work, your good work, and your dedication there in Haiti. My question relates to what we've been hearing about on the news a lot, is that the material that arrives there, I'm sure the airport situation has improved somewhat, but that the materials that arrive are not getting to the people that really need them. And secondly, that there is a lot of government corruption. And I'm just wondering how Oxfam is dealing with those two problems.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'll repeat the question. So that was Mellon asking about the arrival of emergency goods into the airport and whether or not these goods were actually getting into the hands of people who need them. And the second question had to do with government corruption and the consequence of that, and how Oxfam is able to work with the government to get the goods to where people need to have them.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. On the arrival of emergency goods, yes, the airport is completely transformed, even in the 2 months that I have been here. International flights, there's an American Airlines flight and an Air France flight that arrive that come and go daily. I think the American Airlines goes twice a day to Miami now, and there's flights to Panama and all kinds of places. So the airport is no longer an issue. Goods can come and go pretty freely in and out of the airport. So that hasn't been a huge problem. It is, in some parts of the city, we still do have difficulties reaching people, partly because they're in inaccessible areas where, say, a water truck can't go. So then how do we get water up a hill that's 500 feet high and is muddy and slippery all the time? So that's one issue that we have. Another issue is that there are certain parts of town that are a bit dangerous to go into, and security could be an issue for any staff or anybody distributing goods there. So we've been working very closely with community organizations to try to ensure that goods get to those people in a way that reduces any sort of leakage or any corruption as much as we possibly can. In terms of government corruption, the government of Haiti has been notoriously corrupt for very many years. The result of that has been that almost all of the money that comes into Haiti goes to NGOs and private sector organizations. Those nonprofit organizations and private sector organizations, that hasn't had the unfortunate effect of further incapacitating the government, which is part of the reason why you don't have enforcement, for example, that we talked about earlier. The challenge for all of us is now to support the government to rebuild their capacity and to further ensure both for the trust of the citizens of Haiti, but also for the trust of the government's donors, to ensure that there is very little corruption or no corruption. I mean, it's hard to say no corruption because there's always corruption in every country, but at least to reduce that to a level where Haitian people can trust their government again. I was sort of as a side note, I was talking to one of the former prime ministers here who said that he had asked a government to please give him the tools and the methods to monitor corruption in his country. And the country came back to him and said that that they were afraid to give him any tools because they were afraid it would go missing. It's that sort of attitude that we have to work around, and we have to start supporting the government so that they can govern and that people can get expect their government to give them what they need and respond to how they want to be governed.
Thanks. Great. Is there another question, Nelson?
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Sandy Wheel. Please proceed.
Hi. Thank you very much for providing this update. It's extremely informative. I know I received an email from Oxfam recently about kind of advocacy from the standpoint of for the Haitian people and how they want their country rebuilt. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. How are their voices being heard?
Great. Okay, I'll repeat the question. An Oxfam email went out recently talking about advocacy and the importance of making sure that Haitian voices are heard in the reconstruction effort. So, Amy, what is Oxfam doing? What are others doing? How is this panning out?
That's a great question, and thank you so much for asking, and thank you for reading all of the Oxfam information that goes out. It's good to know that the information that we're providing and sending around is being read. There are a number of things that Oxfam is doing right now to ensure that as much as possible the people of Haiti are being heard, not only by their governments, but by the donors as well. First thing we've done is we held a conference with a number of partner organizations with which we work in Haiti to find out what they saw as priorities. The second thing we did was we partnered with the local filmmakers academy in Jacmel to produce a film where they interviewed a number of people around the country so that they would speak at the donors conference in New York on the 31st of March and describe what their priorities were, what they wanted to see, and what they expected of their government. The last thing that we've done recently is we did a public opinion poll of about 1,700 people around the country, in which people were, for one of the first times in their lives, asked what they expected from their government. And those have all been publicized very widely. We've sat down with the Prime Minister and the President and a number of key parliamentarians to talk them through the findings, to explain to them what they found. Other things that are happening in the country, there are a number of call-in radio shows where people can call in and ask questions. Oxfam is sponsoring some of those starting next week. The newspapers have just started being published again, and there are a number of different consultations and fora which the government and the UN are now trying to hold in order to solicit people's feedback. I think the biggest problem is that while this is a democracy, the lack of faith and transparency that people have in the government means that they don't really speak out very often. So what we need to do is start, like I said before, building that trust and confidence so that people feel that when they speak, they will be heard, listened to, and what they say will be acted upon.
Thanks, Amy. Can I just ask one quick question? You mentioned the survey of 1,700 Haitians. What were the top findings in that survey? What did people want most?
After the earthquake, wanted the same things essentially as they wanted before the earthquake. They want food, they want jobs, they want education, they want shelter, and they want food.
Great, okay. The basics.
It's jobs and jobs and jobs. The unemployment rate here before the earthquake was incredible. It's only increased since then.
Do you have any idea what the unemployment rate is now?
Yes, and let me see if I can pull it out of my head, Kirker. It's some incredible number, like 35% or something. It's huge. And it's the unemployment rate among young men and young women in particular is a cause for great concern.
Okay. Are you still there?
And pardon me, we did lose Ms. Ansari's line. I will just step away to reestablish the connection.
Thank you. Yeah. Everyone, we've lost Amy. Nelson is now trying to call her back, and if she doesn't get on, then we'll bid our farewell, but we'll wait a minute or two more while he tries. It took a few minutes to get her before. But if, before we wrap up, if you still have questions that weren't answered in this session, then you can email us, and we will try to answer them for you. And this is the email address that you should send them to. It's info@oxfamamerica.org. And Oxfam America is all one word. And we'll try to get back to you as quickly as we can. And when you're sending us the email questions, it's a good idea to try to put Haiti in the subject line so it doesn't get shuffled off somewhere. So we pay attention right away. Nelson, are you having any luck trying to reach Amy?
Hi, sorry about that. I'm back.
Oh, yay, Amy. All right. I think we have time for one more question. So, Nelson, if there's anyone left in your queue, maybe you could.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Bill Shear. Please proceed.
Hi. Thank you. We have a lot of the Haitians in the church I belong to, and we had planned even last year to have a trip down there for health outreach. A lot of our people, a number of our people went down within a few days of the earthquake, and another organization, a friend of mine, was on a plane coming back from Haiti when the earthquake happened. Now, the problem, one of the problems we're seeing is, and by the way, we're going down again in a couple of months to actually have a health and a construction outreach. One of the problems we saw is that a friend of mine who has been going to Haiti for years now for help, and has a feeding program of about 1,350 people, but that's privately funded and really working down there still. He tried to send down large tents, for example, just a couple of weeks ago, as the rainy season is coming. And this gets at the issue which was discussed a few minutes ago. The large tents got to the airport, and Customs refused to pass them until they got the paperwork resubmitted in ink on the original form, rather than the, I guess, direct forms that were included. So he DHL'd those forms down. Now he's told that the Customs has to wait for a senior administrative official to come there to accept these original signatures and be able to put the tents out with the people. You know, that gets at the government in some way seems to be working against rather than trying to help. I know it's touchy. I know that they're concerned about many issues, and we want to let Haitians do what they can. And by the way, he's all for that. He has to contact the people there would do the distribution and setup. But, you know, it's like Pogo said a long time ago, we've met the enemy and they are us. Isn't there some way we can sort of break through these insane bureaucratic obstacles, which we see in most of the Central and South American countries that we deal with? But now it's critical. Now it's not just a matter of harassment. It's a matter of people aren't getting what they need.
Thank you, Bill. I'll repeat the question for you. Basically, it had to do with bureaucracy. He was describing a situation where tents were trying to be sent into the country by a friend, and there was a lot of tie-up at the airport with customs asking for lots of different kinds of paperwork. So, Amy, what can you say to us about the levels of bureaucracy and how that's going to get ironed out? And I think this will have to be our last question. Thanks.
We've been working in Haiti for 32 years now, so the bureaucracy is familiar to us, and when we work, we plan for that. In the first couple of months after the earthquake, many of the normal bureaucratic measures were dropped from that no longer were necessary here. But in the last few weeks, we've been seeing those measures being put back into place. So for us, when we're even registering our vehicles, has been a little bit of a challenge, and it's taken more time than we would have liked. There's not much that we can do about it except to keep telling the government, telling the UN, and telling the donors where we think the government of Haiti might need some support in helping international organizations to work effectively here, which is a large part of what we do in our advocacy work.
Great. Amy, thank you so much for spending this time with us today and letting us get a sense of what it's like for people there and for those who are working there with them. If anyone, again, has questions that they did not get answered, I'll repeat our email address one more time. It's info@oxfamamerica.org. And please send them along, and we'd be happy to answer. So thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you for all your support.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you very much for your participation and ask you please disconnect your line.